Before I start the show, I just wanted to say thank you to my newest patron. Amy is my new Nightspear, and I just wanted to shout out to Amy and thank you very much for your patronage. I really appreciate you very, very much. Thank you so much for your help. Everyone who helps me out, you are the best, and I love you guys. You're wonderful, and I appreciate you very, very much. So, thank you very much, Amy. Stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to episode 22 of Podcast of the Dragon. I tried to come up with a clever reason about why my first episode about Matt being number 22 is significant. It's an angel number, double digits, one that makes dreams come true, and lucky to boot. But it didn't take much Googling before my head hurt, and I remembered that numerology is bullshit. That said, today I'm going to look at Matt's actions through book 1 and 2, judge him through other people's eyes, and set the stage for him to tell us who he really is in The Dragon Reborn. Matt Cawthon is definitely not everybody's favorite character, but he's still pretty popular. And the people who love him seem to really love him. He seems to inspire the same joyful loyalty in the people who stan him as he does in the soldiers that he leads. And Matt Cawthon is definitely not a character that everyone universally hates through books 1 and 2. Responses to my Twitter poll that I did indicate that nearly 50% of people want to punch his face through the first two books, but another 20% liked him from the get-go and felt that he was just a misunderstood scoundrel. And when it comes to people who love him who don't love him through books 1 and 2, the other poll that I did shows that when they do come to love him, for the majority, their affection begins when he has his awakening and when you finally see him through his own eyes in The Dragon Reborn. I've come to believe at this point that Matt is not necessarily a fan favorite because of his personality. It may be so for some people, but in thinking of myself, because I am very fond of Matt, I like all three of the Taviren boys for different reasons, and I actually don't have a favorite. But considering my own feelings about Matt, I don't think I enjoy him so much because personality-wise, I find Matt especially likable, because he's kind of an asshole. He is the one Emmonsfielder I could possibly be friends with, or at least hang out with, without feeling bored or annoyed or a host of other negative/uncharitable emotions. But I think hanging out and enjoying his company for an evening is the best that I could manage. He lacks the mental/emotional tools for me to be willing to attempt to forge a meaningful friendship with him. Which, honestly, is really awesome when I consider it. I like these people through the eyes of people who love, like, and admire them, and I enjoy them through their own eyes, even when it's sad because they don't really like themselves. But I myself, the person that I am, could not connect with them, would struggle to understand them, would feel impatient with them, and the idea of sitting at a table with them and trying to have a conversation is torturous. And when you look at that divergence between how you experience a person as RJ presents them through unreliable narrators, and how you'd experience them if they were real and it was your own internal narrative telling you things about them, it shows a layered understanding of the many nuances of people, and it's one of the reasons why I come back to the Wheel of Time again and again. So, At least for myself, I'm beginning to think that what I find so delightful about Matt is less the person that he is, though I do find him very fun, and more the utterly unique way in which he is written. The other main characters are built in their arcs in a very methodical manner. If you were to compare them to art, they're very straightforward sketches or drawings that get filled in and built upon in a really beautiful fashion. There are rich details and texture, but they're still constructed in a really direct and linear way. But Matt is like an abstract painting, where RJ just lays on this sloppy layer of paint and then immediately goes nuts and swipes through it and scribbles over it. And what you end up with is a totally novel form of characterization. Of course people love Matt. He's interesting. Matt thinks one thing, says another, and does a third thing, which is a characteristic that is remarked upon by many people. And it's one of the reasons why I try not to give Brandon Sanderson too hard a time for the fact that he didn't nail his character. He couldn't really write him well. And he himself has admitted as much, and I have heard that he said to Rafe Judkins, "Don't underestimate how difficult it is to write Matt." I think Matt is so layered and unusual that it would be impossible for anyone who is not RJ to live inside and personify that character. And speaking as someone who has written characters that I have been told come across as incredibly real and genuine, there's no way to explain how to do that. You just live in them, and they're part of you, and you pour them out, and at least for me personally, I don't know where the fuck they came from. So to try to figure out how to recreate that and to make someone else's character, I don't blame Sanderson for not being able to do that. I wouldn't blame anyone for that. What a thankless fucking task. Honestly, the characterization that RJ does for Matt is so complicated. I think he would have been really difficult to write, at least before he goes through the second doorway and gets his memories and is finally as complete in his mind as he'll ever be. And it's so strange how he's presented to us through books 1 and 2. He's shown to us through the eyes of people who don't really understand him, or at least they dismiss him as simple when really he is anything but. And then, once you're inside his mind in book 3, you get to see how little he understands himself, because whatever abilities he woke up with in Tar Valon, self-awareness was not one of them. And so you're in the head of someone who's thinking one thing and saying another thing because he doesn't even really understand what he thinks. He chooses to take no time to give his thoughts further contemplation. There is no navel gazing for Matram Cawthon. And then, with no regard to anything he has thought or said, he goes and does something else because he's just action and impulse, and almost like he doesn't even want to be how he is. And he's so interesting. Contradictory people are frustrating, but they're sure entertaining. One of the weirdest things about it, I think, is that it isn't 100% fair to use the person that we know from books 1 and 2 to inform our understanding of Matt. Whoever that kid is, through the Eye of the World and the Great Hunt, the one who wakes in Tar Valon can't even remember who he is, or can barely remember who he is. But when he does wake, we, the readers, at least get point of views where we can learn him. The other characters, his friends, or Nynaeve, who I don't ever really think of as his friend because she can never stop seeing him as a kid or a scoundrel, they continue to judge the person that they knew, which is, I think, one of the reasons why he struggled so much with them. They hold against him the person that he was and the immature things that he did, and they don't realize he can't remember most of it. Which brings about a philosophical question. Should a person with amnesia be held accountable for things they've done or behaviors they've engaged in that they don't remember? I think one of the reasons that Matt becomes so much more likable in The Dragon Reborn, at least for those of us who struggle to like or appreciate him through the first 2 books, is that we finally see him from the perspective of someone who holds him in decent or reasonable regard. And it's not like he walks around thinking that he's such hot shit. But he does like himself, and he has a reasonably decent opinion of himself. He does not dismiss himself as immature and childish. He has faith in his own abilities, and he feels like he has a decent brain. And I think one of the reasons why he's so flustered and he struggles so much with his memories being gone is just the fact that he generally enjoys being himself, and so not having a solid sense of who that person is so disorienting for him, and it leaves him feeling like he has very little control over his life. Before The Dragon Reborn, we really only see Matt from Rand and Perrin's point of views. And then within those point of views, we get the basic information that RJ sketches, which tells us not just how Rand and Perrin feel about Matt or perceive him, but also the habits, the gestures, the actions that he takes, and we can surmise things about the person that he is from those actions, regardless of how Rand or Perrin interpret those things. So, we first see him at the end of Chapter 1 of The Eye of the World, and we get as Rand is standing listening to his father and Senbui and the mayor talk, and Sen is talking shit about Nynaeve. It says, a quick tug at Rand's sleeve and a voice pitched low for his ear alone distracted him from the older men's talk. Come on, Rand, while they're arguing, before they put you to work. Rand glanced down and had to grin. Matt Cawthon crouched beside the cart so Tam and Bran and Sen could not see him, his wiry body contorted like a stork trying to bend itself double. Matt's brown eyes twinkled with mischief as usual. Dav and I caught a big old badger, all grouchy at being pulled out of his den. We're going to let it loose on the green and watch the girls run. Rand's smile broadened. It did not sound as much like fun to him as it would have a year or two back, but Matt never seemed to grow up. He took a quick look at his father. The men had their heads together still, all three talking at once, then lowered his own voice. I promise to unload the cider. I can meet you later, though. Matt rolled his eyes skyward. Toting barrels? Burn me, I'd rather play stones with my baby sister. So, we can hear from Rand's inner narrative that Matt is immature and that he's already outgrown him. You can see that he's fond of Matt, and Matt makes him smile because Matt's goofy and fun, but he honestly doesn't think harassing wildlife in order to frighten girls sounds very entertaining. Rand would probably go along with it, since we see later on that Matt is talented at peer pressure, and it would probably get him into trouble. But Rand, when it's put to him, doesn't just feel meh about it. He is actually at the point where he is articulating to himself, Matt doesn't seem to grow up. And Rand has, at least to a certain extent. Pre-Shatter Logoth, RJ does a good job of showing Matt in a handful of situations that provide pretty effective characterization for him based upon actions, rather than the perspective of an unreliable narrator. Before the Trolloc attack, he's bragging to Tom Marilyn when Tom is teasing them about being country bumpkins. He's bragging about how far they've explored. He's like, you know, hey, we've been all over. We've been to the Sand Hills and the foot of the Mountains of Mist. And it lets us see that Matt likes to wander, and he's happy to go far and wide and to tell exuberant tales about it. And we also see just through his choices, with nothing of Rand's judgment behind it, how poor his critical thinking skills are in the beginning, and how unwilling he is to take responsibility for his actions. Master Luhan is mad because Matt put flour all over his dogs as a prank, and Matt's defensive response to Rand is, how was I supposed to know they would run back home? It's not my fault. They left the door open. Anyone with half a brain would know that they would go home, and it is absolutely Matt's fault. He's just not at the point where he's grown up enough to take responsibility for his actions. Then the party leaves the Two Rivers, and RJ shows Matt in these moments of immaturity and impulsiveness and the inability to think before he speaks. He lays out the great scene in Barlon in The Stag and Lion where you see Matt in the bathtub and he cannot shut the fuck up. The bath attendant mentions Trollocs up in Saldaea, and Matt feels that immediate impulsive rush of like, oh, I've got a better story than that, and he just cannot help himself because his intelligent adult brain has not taken over, it probably doesn't even exist yet, to tell him, however good your story is, Matt, you're not to talk about that because you've been told not to, it's dangerous and stupid and you need to keep it to yourself. Matt just can't not. And when Rand and he are out walking around the streets of Barlon, and he sees the White Cloaks in their white cloaks, and he's like, God, they look like assholes. It'd be fun to do something to make them look like even bigger assholes. And so he quickly calculates, what could I do that I can reasonably get away with? And Matt is lucky enough that though he has plenty of pranks that don't go his way, they go his way often enough. And slinging a rock from stealth to hit a secondary target so that the White Cloaks will never understand why the barrels come rolling towards them stands an excellent chance of not getting caught. If he does it from a sneaky hiding place on the second floor of a shop, they'll never know. And they never did. They were just outraged because Rand laughed his ass off at them. One of my favorite small moments of characterization for Matt is before they even get to Barlon in the chapter called Choices, where Matt is running his mouth as he does and talking without thinking as he does. And in the midst of that behavior that we're learning is typical, RJ shows us a bit more of Matt's personality and what he wants from life and also his dumbassery. It's just all beautifully rolled up into this one horribly awkward moment. And they're definitely due for another awkward moment, since it's two nights since Rand and Egwene had the screaming match where Rand suggested that Moraine was a dark friend. It says, "Two nights later, with the fire burning low, Matt licked the last crumbs of cheese from his fingers and said, 'You know, I think we've lost them for good.' Lon was off in the night, taking a last look around. Moraine and Egwene had gone aside for one of their conversations. Tom was half-dozing over his pipe, and the young men had the fire to themselves. Perrin, idly poking the embers with a stick, answered, 'If we've lost them, why does Lon keep scouting?' Nearly asleep, Rand rolled over, his back to the fire. 'We lost them back at Terran Ferry.' Matt lay back with his fingers laced behind his head, staring at the moon-filled sky. 'If they were even really after us.' 'You think that Drakkar was chasing us because it liked us?' Perrin asked. 'I say stop worrying about Trollocs and such,' Matt went on as if Perrin had not spoken, 'and start thinking about seeing the world. We're out where the stories come from. What do you think a real city is like?' 'We're going to Barlon,' Rand said sleepily, but Matt snorted. 'Barlon's all very well, but I've seen that old map Master Alvear has. If we turn south once we reach Camelin, the road leads all the way to Ilion and beyond.' 'What's so special about Ilion?' Perrin said, yawning. 'For one thing,' Matt replied, 'Ilion isn't full of ice.' A silence fell, and Rand was suddenly wide awake. Moraine had come back early. Egwene was with her, but it was the Aes Sedai standing at the edge of the firelight who held their attention. Matt lay there on his back, his mouth still open, staring at her. Moraine's eyes caught the light like dark polished stones. Abruptly, Rand wondered how long she had been standing there. And, of course, this is the scene where Moraine tells them that before she lets the Dark One have them, she'll kill them herself. But in that uncomfortable scene, along with showcasing the behavior, Matt will continue in Barlon and up to Shatterlogoth, which is thoughtlessness and impulsiveness and speaking without thinking. We see that unlike Rand and Perrin, Matt is kind of here for this. He's cool with being out in the world. He's not here for the danger, but because Matt is full of self-delusion, and RJ shows us that too in his willingness to tell himself, "They're not after us." He is definitely here for being out in the world and seeing places. He didn't really think about leaving before that. I mean, his ambitions that you learn in The Dragon Reborn is that he wanted to own the biggest farm in the Two Rivers. That was his, you know, when I grow up, I want to. So he would never have left on his own. But now that he's out, he's kind of like, oh shit, let's go see some places. I am down to do this. And beyond seeing all of that, we also see that he isn't cool with Aes Sedai. And this is the first time we're made aware of that. You've only interacted with him a couple of times after the whole attack on Winter Night, where you're getting dialogue with him. You get where he's telling Rand, "Hey, this isn't much like the stories, is it, Rand?" Or he tells Egwene, trying to dissuade her from coming along, that, "Hey, this isn't a picnic trip into the Waterwood." So this is the first moment where you see he doesn't like Aes Sedai. He doesn't want to be around them. And sure, Moraine has sunk the ferry at this point, and I think that for all of the boys, that kind of cemented their disquiet and distrust of Aes Sedai. But this lays the foundation for another of Matt's continued themes throughout the story, which is that he's afraid of Aes Sedai, he doesn't trust Aes Sedai, he does not want Aes Sedai in his life. He wants to be as far from them as he can. If Matt is an abstract painting, the first layers are kind of laid down up to Shatterlogoth, and then at that place, RJ starts muddying him up and getting creative. He gets creative with him once Matt picks up the dagger. And I still hold to the belief that the dagger had multiple purposes. It was a literary device to help keep Matt alive, since otherwise he would have been running his mouth and oversharing and gotten himself killed and probably gotten Rand killed with him. But beyond that, the dagger is the thing that leads Matt to his powers. Not just because the dagger sets his path toward his fate. In some way that we are never given to understand, the dagger leads him to the first of his powers, which is his luck. In The Dragon Reborn, as he's having his incredibly lucky night in Tar Valon, and he has gone out for some air because he's freaked out, someone has said that he has the Dark One's own luck, and it's scared him. It says, holding the quarterstaff upright in front of him with both hands, he lowered his head to his fists and tried to think at the puzzle from every side. He knew he was lucky. He could remember always being lucky. But somehow his memories from Emmons Field did not show him as lucky as he had been since leaving. Certainly he had gotten away with a great deal, but he could remember also being caught in pranks he had been sure would succeed. His mother had always seemed to know what he was up to, and Nynaeve able to see through whatever defenses he put up. But it was not just since leaving the Two Rivers that he had become lucky. The luck had come once he took the dagger from Shadur Logoth. He remembered playing at dice back home with a sharp-eyed skinny man who worked for a merchant come down from Barlon to buy tobacco. He remembered the strapping his father had given him, too, on learning Matt owed the man a silver mark and 4 pence. "But I'm free of the bloody dagger," he mumbled. "Those bloody eyes that I said I was." He wondered how much he had won tonight. When he dug into his coat pockets, he found them filled with loose coins, crowns and marks, both silver and gold, that glittered and glinted in the light from nearby windows. He had 2 purses now, it seemed, and both fat. He undid the strings and found more gold, and still more, stuffed into his belt pouch between and around and on top of his dice cups, crumpling Elaine's letter and the Ammerlin's paper. He had a memory of tossing silver pence to serving girls because they had pretty smiles or pretty eyes or pretty ankles, and because silver pence were not worth keeping. Not worth keeping? Maybe they weren't. Light, I'm rich. I am bloody rich. Maybe it was something the Aes Sedai did. Something they did healing me. By accident, maybe. That could be it. Better than the other. The bloody Aes Sedai must have done it to me. So, this just shows Matt once again willfully telling himself it has to be a certain way because he doesn't want it to be another way. Just as because he wants to go to Ilion, he's telling himself, the Shadowspawn weren't really after us. So, Robert Jordan paints Matt as impulsive and immature up to Shadur Logoth, and he has also already let us know, when we first meet him, that he's a bit of an explorer. He's a wanderer full of curiosity, which makes it super believable when he runs off in the city and peer pressures his dumbass friends into coming with him, as he has peer pressured them into doing all kinds of idiotic things over the course of their young lives. He tells himself what he wants to believe, as is his habit, and assumes Trollocs are afraid of this place means Shadur Logoth is safe, and we all know that that's piss-poor logic and abominable critical thinking, but we've already been shown, too, that Matt has piss-poor logic and abominable critical thinking. And you also have to think that Matt went through an incredibly traumatic battle before Shadur Logoth, and there's something about trauma that can often make people want to do desperately risky things after to just kind of blow off steam. And I debate with myself about whether the battle was more traumatic for Matt than for anyone else, because you cannot put a scale on trauma or determine that one person's trauma is more impactful than another's, since different people are affected by different things in different ways. But feeling helpless is traumatic. Matt had a bow, and having a ranged weapon is only so good, because once they got surrounded by the Trollocs, he had no way to really defend himself. Before the Trollocs closed the distance, he was admittedly in much better shape than anyone except Moraine and maybe Lon. He was certainly far more skilled in the use of his weapon than Perrin or Rand, and maybe that sense of competence and comfort and feeling settled and skillful in using his weapon is what caused him to start shouting in the old tongue. He wasn't just waving around a piece of metal that he honestly had no fucking clue really how to use despite Lon trying to teach him. And then just grabbing at random for something to yell and settling on, Manetherin, Manetherin. He was centered and steady within himself because he was skilled with his weapon and knew what he was doing. So, as well as anybody could be doing when facing a horde of Trollocs, he was okay, at least until they came in close. But then they're in close and they're surrounding, and he gets unseated from his horse. RJ did some wonderful little foreshadowing where one of the Trollocs with the noose catch poles gets Matt, and after Lon kills the Paid and all of the Trollocs are dying, Rand looks at Matt, and Matt is pulling the noose off his neck and shuddering. And that, no doubt, was pretty fucking terrifying and traumatic, because I'm sure that they all, except for Lon and Moraine, and maybe Tom, if Tom knew that Murdrel could link with Trollocs, and if they did and Lon killed the Murdrel, then all the Trollocs would also die. I bet they all were assuming that they were dead. They were all assuming they were dead. And so what that would do to your brain with just the terrible trauma and fear of it, I think that it fucked him up, and afterwards he just needed to do something desperate and risky to deal with the emotion dump. You know, J.K. Rowling can fuck off for all kinds of reasons, but she does understand to a certain extent an adolescent's desire to, when they are emotionally agitated, engage in risk-taking. She explores that quite a lot in Harry Potter and the later books, and it's real. Fuck you, J.K. Rowling, but it's real. So it says, as Rand laid Bella's saddle on the floor, he noticed that Matt had taken on a glum stare. His eyes seemed 1,000 miles away, and he was moving by rote. Are you all right, Matt? Rand said. Matt lifted the saddle from his horse and stood holding it. Matt? Matt! Matt gave a start and almost dropped the saddle. What? Oh, I was just thinking. Thinking? Perrin hooted from where he was replacing Mandarb's bridle with a hackamore. You were asleep. Matt scowled. I was thinking about what happened back there. About those words. Everybody turned to look at him then, not just Rand, and he shifted uneasily. Well, you heard what Moraine said. It's as if some dead man was speaking with my mouth. I don't like it. Which is another beautiful moment of foreshadowing there. But it's also like, RJ very much understood what it was like to be an adolescent young man, and particularly an adolescent young man who experienced trauma. And so the idea that something would work on your head really bad like that, and then afterwards you might feel the desire to do something desperate and risky, whether it would be to get shit-faced and play Russian roulette, or, you know, run off and explore a murder city looking for treasure, and then hop into a white van with a creepy man when he's like, I've got treasure. I mean, follow him into a building, but, you know, whatever, just to cope and blow off steam. Jordan was obviously an intelligent and very complex person. And it seems like the three boys are expressions of three different types of trauma and coping. Rand is this kind of like spiraling mental illness and self-punishment and self-loathing. And then Perrin is just grim, practical stoicism. And for Matt is just like dark humor and avoidance. And honestly, there is something to be said for avoidance and humor when trauma is ongoing, and therefore there's no time to process. You don't have any fucking time to do anything about it. There's no time for therapy, so not worrying about it and laughing it off, that's not an unreasonable way to cope in a terrible situation. Honestly, it's one of the best ways to cope in a terrible situation, at least I think so. So, for Perrin, in his vision of Matt, we get a perfect glimpse of that after they're separated and fleeing Shatter Logoth, and we get inside Perrin's head for the first time. It says, he knew that Matt, and almost everyone else in Emmons Field, considered him slow of thought. It was partly because he was big and usually moved carefully. He had always been afraid he might accidentally break something or hurt somebody since he was so much bigger than the boys he grew up with, but he really did prefer to think things all the way through if he could. Quick thinking, careless thinking, had put Matt into hot water one time after another, and Matt's quick thinking usually managed to get Rand or him or both in the cookpot alongside Matt, too. So, there's a sense of frustration there. Earlier, he got peer pressured by Matt, who was a dick about it, into going out and exploring the murder city. When Perrin's like, we should ask Moraine, Matt's like, oh yeah, we gotta ask Moraine, you wanna ask Mistress Luhan too? And he was just a shit about it. And Perrin, who is sensitive and has self-esteem issues, gave into it. And I think he gives into a lot with Matt. Perrin doesn't like being thought dumb. And Perrin assumes that that's what everybody thinks, which is not necessarily true. If we take Perrin's assumptions at face value, you know, it can add to the perception that Matt's a dick. And while personally I think that Matt peer-pressuring Perrin makes Matt a dick, I don't believe that Matt consciously or cruelly plays on any perception that Perrin has low self-esteem, especially because I think that Matt actually thinks Perrin is very smart. Once we get inside Matt's head and the Dragon Reborn, we see that he doesn't think Perrin's stupid. After he gets the fireworks from Aludra as a reward for rescuing her from Tammuz and the other Illuminators in the barn in Arangil, and Matt is dissecting one by the fire when he and Tom are camping, it says, "Haven't you ever heard those things explode 10 times as hard for air as for fire? Fireworks are the next thing to Aes Sedai work, boy." "Maybe," Matt said, "but Aludra did not look like any Aes Sedai to me. I used to think that about Master Alvir's clock, that it had to be Aes Sedai work, but once I got the back of the cabinet open, I saw it was full of little pieces of metal." He shifted uncomfortably at the memory. Mistress Alvir had been the first to reach him that time, with the wisdom and his father and the mayor all right behind her, and none believing he just meant to look. I could have put them all back together. I think Perrin could make one if he saw those little wheels and springs and I don't know what all. "You would be surprised, boy," Tom said dryly. "Even a bad clockmaker is a fairly rich man, and they earn it, but a clock does not explode in your face. Neither did this. Well, it's useless now." He tossed the handful of paper and little pebbles into the fire to a screech from Tom. The pebbles sparked and made tiny flashes, and there was a smell of acrid smoke. So I don't know if what Tom said indicates that he thinks Perrin's stupid, or if he's just pushing back at Matt's dismissal of him comparing complex and potentially dangerous things to Aes Sedai work. I suspect it's the latter. Regardless, I don't think Matt thinks Perrin's stupid at all. I don't think Matt would think that Perrin could make a clock if he believed he was dumb. He's like, a clock might not be Aes Sedai work if you open it up and see all the metal pieces moving together, but it's not simple. And he doesn't look at it and think it's easy. He thinks, yeah, I could have put it all back together, sure. And he's like, I bet Perrin could make one, because Perrin's talented, and Perrin's smart, and he knows it, and he thinks it. We see 4 stages of Matt in the Eye of the World. We see pre-Winter Night and post-Winter Night Matt, where he's more or less the same impulsive idiot, and the latter is just more eager to see the world and run away from trouble. We get post-Shatter Logoth Matt, where he is poisoned by the dagger and suspicious of everyone, where whenever Rand wants to talk about the others and be hopeful, Matt is like, they're all dead, and he's just utterly hopeless and shitty to everybody and just an asshole. And then Moraine seals the dagger away and wards it so that Matt is no longer affected by it, and his mind is once again his own. And you get... The door opened, and for a moment Rand thought he was still imagining. Matt stood there blinking, with his coat buttoned up and the dark scarf wrapped low around his forehead. Then Rand saw Moraine with her hand on Matt's shoulder, and Lon behind them. The Aes Sedai was watching Matt carefully, as one watches someone only lately out of a sickbed. As always, Lon was watching everything while appearing to watch nothing. Matt looked as if he had never been sick a day. His first hesitant smile included everyone, though it slipped into an open-mouthed stare at the sight of Loyal, as if he were seeing the Ogier for the first time. With a shrug and a shake, he turned his attention back to his friends. He took a deep breath. It seems as if I've been acting sort of oddly. I don't remember much of it, really. He gave Moraine an uneasy look. She smiled back confidently, and he went on. Everything is hazy after Whitebridge. Tom and the... He shivered and hurried on. The further from Whitebridge, the hazier it gets. I don't really remember arriving in Camelin at all. He eyed Loyal askance. Not really. Moraine Sedai says I... Upstairs, I... He grinned, and suddenly he truly was the old Matt. You can't hold a man to blame for what he does when he's crazy, can you? And so, here, Matt turns into the reluctantly dutiful Matt. They begin to discuss their plans, and they learn about the Eye of the World and make the decision to go to the Blight. And Matt is super unhappy about going to the Blight. He's like, why do we fucking have to go? But they figured out that they're all Tavirin, and Moraine's like, this is the danger. We have to go fight the Dark One. And so he does, because where the fuck else is he gonna go? Rand is going, and Perrin's gonna go with Rand, and Matt is attached to Rand, and Rand is kind of the one who he follows after. And then, when they're going to the Blight, and Ingtar is really upset about the fact that he's not allowed to follow them, Matt mutters to Rand that he can have my place, because he is being dutiful, but he's not thrilled about it. In The Great Hunt, Matt is kind of like Asshole Matt 2.0, but at the very beginning of the story, we see him genuinely relaxed and cheerful for a very short period of time. The Ommerlin Seed arrives at Faldara Keep, and Rand is desperately trying to get out, and he's wandering around because the gates are all barred and there's an order that no one can come in or out, and he wanders into a storeroom, and he's talking to Loial like, hey, can you help me get out? And Loial's like, nah, the city we built was raised in the Trolloc Wars. And Loial's concerned, he calls Matt and Perrin over, because Rand's super upset and has just, like, squeezed his eyes shut with despair and slumped against the wall. It says, Rand opened his eyes to see his friend straightening up out of the knot of dicers. Matt Cawthon, long-limbed as a stork, wearing a half-smile as if he saw something funny that no one else saw. Shaggy-haired Perrin Ibarra, with heavy shoulders and thick arms from work as a blacksmith's apprentice. They both still wore their Two Rivers garb, plain and sturdy, but travel-worn. Matt tossed the dice back into the semicircle as he stepped out, and one of the men called, "Here, Southlander, you can't quit while you're winning." "Better than when I'm losing," Matt said with a laugh. "You'll have another chance to win it back." Wry snorts from the kneeling men indicated they did not think there was much chance of that. Perrin kept his eyes down as he followed Matt across to Rand. Perrin always kept his eyes down these days, and his shoulders sagged as if he carried a weight too heavy even for their width. "What's the matter, Rand?" Matt asked. "You're as white as your shirt." "Hey, where did you get those clothes? You turning Shinarin? Maybe I'll buy myself a coat like that and a fine shirt." He shook his coat pocket, producing a clink of coins. "I seem to have luck with the dice. I can hardly touch them without winning." "You don't have to buy anything," Rand said tiredly. "Moraine had all our clothes replaced. They're burned already for all I know, all but what you two were wearing. Alonsu will probably be around to collect those too, so I'd change fast if I were you before she takes them off your back." Perrin still did not look up, but his cheeks turned red. Matt's grin deepened, though it looked forced. They too had had encounters in the baths, and only Matt tried to pretend it did not matter. So, Matt seems genuinely relaxed and happy here. He's enjoying himself. They succeeded at the Eye of the World, and it's like no skin off his ass at this point. He's at the stage of what Egwene thinks of him being much later on, as Matt just simply has to be. He doesn't really have any responsibility. He's just waiting to be healed from the dagger, and he knows that that's a thing that will happen, and he's not thrilled about it because he doesn't like having the one power used on him. But if it has to be, once you get inside his head, you see that he's practical enough to understand that if it's something that has to be done, then it has to be done. And he's super laid back and happy until the scene in the storeroom where Rand spurns his willingness to flee with him. You know, Rand is like, "I have to get out, I have to get out." And Matt's like, "Okay, okay, let's pack our shit. Let's go, we'll go." And Rand at first tries to use logic to keep Matt from going with him, since Matt has to stay and be healed. And I'm guessing he would have convinced Perrin not to come with him by saying, "Stay with Matt, he needs someone to look out for him." But once Matt starts talking about how maybe he doesn't want Aes Sedai help, maybe he'll be worse off if he lets them heal him, and Rand's just thinking, what a fucking idiot. You know, he has to tell him, "No, I'm not going with you. Fuck off." And for Matt, he's just like, "What? No, what are you talking about?" And then Rand just goes on to be so mean and cruel in a way that Matt, who doesn't have the memories to go with the emotions that he feels for Rand, and has the sense of attachment without retaining the actual experiences to back them up, is just devastated. Devastated and so angry about it. He's so fucking angry because he's so hurt. And it's like, Perrin's hurt. But Perrin isn't trauma-bonded to Rand the way Matt is, and I don't think Perrin's quite as close to Rand. You know, Perrin's more trauma bonded to Egwene. They're trauma buddies. And I think Matt has always been a little bit more attached to Rand. And he knows that Rand is the one he can count on. And when the person that you depend on abandons you, he's just devastated. He doesn't remember past Whitebridge, but emotionally, Rand is safety. Rand is home. And I think that much of his bad behavior in the Great Hunt toward Rand just comes from the fact that he is hurt so badly. And some of his shitty behavior can probably also be tied to the stress of having what amounts to a maybe terminal, but not positively terminal, disease. And, you know, I can't imagine what that would be like. I had cancer about 10 years ago, and I had 8 days where all I knew was that the diagnosis was cancer, but I wasn't yet able to talk to the oncologist or the surgeon, and so I didn't know any more than that, except a passing comment from the doctor who gave me the bad news, who was like, "It's a little worrying that the tumor is so big," which, you know, I was extra and specially upset about that, as you can imagine. But I had 8 days where I had no information, and it was super fucking horrible. It was really horrible to have to, with no information, try to figure my shit out while wondering, how am I going to cope with this? Because I'm someone who doesn't do very well feeling miserable and unhappy, and I do whatever I can to think my way through it so I can stop feeling miserable and unhappy. And the anxiety that accompanies not knowing how bad your condition is, and whether it's going to hit the bad enough threshold that it's going to be fatal, that is a horrible place to be. And it ended up being something where the surgeon wasn't that worried about it, so I felt more comforted, and we were able to schedule the surgery right away, because I was fortunate enough, even though I live in the United States, to have very good health insurance. I had good health insurance, and I was able to literally have surgery like the next week. And I got the results of my lymph nodes being checked back, and it wasn't in the lymph nodes, and they gave me some just-in-case radiation, and I was pretty much good to go. And yeah, you know, I suffer lasting effects because of it, but overall, it was an easy enough experience to deal with. And the only serious fear that I had was over the course of those 8 days, and it was fucking terrible. With Matt, it's like the Dark Friends take the dagger, and then the heroes have to be like, you know, are we gonna get it back? Are we gonna get it back? And it's sort of like when Rand gets it back, and then he has to tell Matt that he lost it again, which, for Rand, you know, I've never really gone back and looked at it from that point of view to think about how bad that had to be. You know, like, he was sad about the horn, but the dagger is what he really cares about. He cares about Matt. And so losing the dagger again is so crushing to him. If I were in Matt's shoes, at least once I learned that the Dark Friends had taken the horn to Tommen Head, I probably at that point would have resigned myself to death. And I would have made it just my duty at that point to find the horn. And that would have been my goal. I will hunt for the horn until I eventually die. And that's just what I'm going to do. That's my job now. And I would have had a conversation with Varen and been like, "So, hey, if you use the one power to euthanize somebody, does that count as using it as a weapon?" Because at the point that I got sick enough, I would just want her to put me out of my misery if I were Matt. And that's just the way that my mind works, where I would want to think through the practicalities of it, because at some point, I would just have to mentally let the dagger go and assume that all was lost. And I would still try to look for it, because it was with the horn, but I would not assume or keep hoping that I would find it, because that would be too anxiety-inducing and too painful. I would be able to be happy assuming that I was going to die. Living in a place where you might die, but you might live? That's horrible anxiety. And so I think that stress is one of the reasons that Matt is so shitty in The Great Hunt. He doesn't resign himself to death and assume, yeah, I'm probably fucked and that's okay. And the hurt that he feels from Rand's rejection, and the stress that he feels from maybe gonna die, maybe not, none of that excuses his behavior when he learns about Rand being able to channel. He's already childishly rebuffing Rand's attempts to apologize. Rand feels like a piece of shit for trying to push them away, for being mean, and just in general. And his childish refusal to accept Rand's apology is understandable in the sense that if Matt can't articulate to himself why he is so hurt, it's hard to process that. You're feeling really strong feelings of anger and hurt, and you can't even get to the point of working through it because you don't know exactly why it's so powerful. Emotions are treacherous and illogical and so hard to handle sometimes when they're powerful. Take it from someone who has to deal with intensely powerful emotions that sometimes can be so overwhelming I just have to sit down and let them take over and basically just sit with them because I can't function beyond wrestling with them. And I've always appreciated the description of Rand struggling with Sidene and trying not to be swept away, because that's often what it feels like for me trying to deal with the strength and tempestuousness of my emotions. And I can see for Matt, if he can't process what he's feeling, it may be that it's just too much and he has to shove Rand away. But he's also trying too hard. He's trying too hard. And he's forcing Perrin makes the choice to not be like, you know what, Matt, I'm not going to play this game. Rand said he was sorry. Because Perrin's upset too. He's just sort of like, you said that we couldn't come with you. You know, I would have accepted your apology except for that. But the childish behavior of kicking Rand out of their group, not letting him ride with them, not letting him sleep with them, it makes most readers feel very impatient with Matt, and particularly someone like me, who feels so strongly for and can identify so powerfully with Book 2 Rand. After Ingtar gives Rand his banner and he goes to look at it and the other two boys follow him into the bushes and see, Rand gets pissed and is like, yeah, the Aes Sedai want me for a false dragon. It says, Matt had backed up against a tree trunk. A false dragon? He swallowed. You? That's crazy. Perrin had not retreated. He squatted down with his thick arms on his knees and studied Rand with those bright golden eyes. In the evening shadows they seemed to shine. If the Aes Sedai want you for a false dragon, he paused, frowning, thinking things through. Finally he said quietly, Rand, can you channel? Matt gave a strangled gasp. Rand let the banner drop. He hesitated only a moment before nodding wearily. I did not ask for it. I don't want it. But I do not think I know how to stop it. The room with the flies came back unbidden to his mind. I don't think they'll let me stop. Burn me! Matt breathed. Blood and bloody ashes! They'll kill us, you know. All of us. Perrin and me as well as you. If Ingtar and the others find out, they will cut our bloody throats for Dark Friends. Light, they'll probably think we were part of stealing the horn and killing those people in Faldara. Shut up, Matt, Perrin said calmly. Don't tell me to shut up. If Ingtar doesn't kill us, Rand will go mad and do it for him. Burn me! Burn me! Matt slid down the tree to sit on the ground. Why didn't they gentle you? If the Aes Sedai know, why didn't they gentle you? I never heard of them letting a man who can wield the power just walk away. They don't all know, Rand sighed. The Ommerlin. The Ommerlin seat? She knows? Light, no wonder she looked at me so strange. And Moraine told me I'm the dragon reborn, and then they said I could go wherever I wanted. Don't you see, Matt? They are trying to use me. Doesn't change you being able to channel, Matt muttered. If I were you, I'd be halfway to the Arth Ocean by now, and I would not stop until I found some place where there were no Aes Sedai and never likely to be any, and no people. I mean... Well, shut up, Matt, Perrin said. Why are you here, Rand? The longer you stay around people, the more likely it is somebody will find out and send for Aes Sedai. Aes Sedai who won't tell you to go on about your business. He paused, scratching his head over that. And Matt's right about Ingtar. I don't doubt he would name you Dark Friend and kill you. Kill all of us, maybe. He seems to like you, but he'd still do it, I think. A false dragon? So would the others. Massima wouldn't need that much excuse for you. So why aren't you gone? Rand shrugged. I was going, but first the Ommerlin came, and then the horn was stolen, and the dagger, and Moraine said Matt was dying, and... Light, I thought I could stay with you until we found the dagger, at least. I thought I could help with that. Maybe I was wrong. You came because of the dagger, Matt said quietly. He rubbed his nose and grimaced. I never thought of that. I never thought you wanted to... Are you feeling all right? I mean, you aren't going mad already, are you? Rand dug a pebble out of the ground and threw it at him. Ouch! Matt rubbed his arm. I was just asking. I mean, all those fancy clothes and all that talk about being a lord, well, that isn't exactly right in the head. I was trying to get rid of you, fool. I was afraid I'd go mad and hurt you. His eyes dropped to the banner and his voice lowered. I will eventually if I don't stop it. Like, I don't know how to stop it. That is what I'm afraid of, Matt said, standing. No offense, Rand, but I think I will just sleep as far away from you as I can, if you don't mind. That's if you were staying. I heard about a fellow who could channel once. A merchant's guard told me. Before the Red Aja found him, he woke one morning and his whole village was smashed flat. All the houses, all the people, everything but the bed he was sleeping in, like a mountain had rolled over them. Perrin said, in that case, Matt, you should sleep cheek by jowl with him. I may be a fool, but I intend to be a live fool. Matt hesitated, looking sideways at Rand. Look, I know you came along to help me, and I am grateful. I really am. But you just are not the same anymore. You understand that, don't you? He waited as if he expected an answer. None came. Finally, he vanished into the trees back toward the camp. What about you? Rand asked. Perrin shook his head, shaggy curls swinging. I don't know, Rand. You are the same, but then again, you aren't. A man channeling. My mother used to frighten me with that when I was little. I just do not know. He stretched out his hand and touched a corner of the banner. I think I would burn this or bury it if I were you. Then I'd run so far, so fast, no Aes Sedai would ever find me. Matt was right about that. And that's really hard. Because Matt seems super cruel there. And it's hard to empathize with that. But I also think that it's impossible for us to imagine or find any kind of corollary to the notion of a man who can channel and the type of fear that they engender. The best that I can come up with is like a dangerous animal that people who are comfortable around don't fear in the same way. People who live in bear country don't find bears as terrifying as I do. But they're still wary, and they know that they're dangerous. There's little else that people are taught to fear that compares. Not that I can think of any way. And so Matt is shocked, and he can't empathize with Rand. He doesn't have, at least in the Great Hunt, he doesn't yet have this dirty boy thing that Rand and Perrin both have. Perrin understands Rand. He understands what that feels like to be tainted, and so he's less troubled by it. He acknowledges that, yeah, it's dangerous that you can channel Rand, but he doesn't feel the sense of disgust that Matt feels, because he's just kind of like, yeah, I get it, I get it. And I think he also is probably thinking to himself, you haven't killed anyone yet, Rand, and that makes you one up on me. In his first point of view in The Dragon Reborn, as he's trying to remember, Matt is having these kind of stream of consciousness thoughts and thinking through Aes Sedai and remembering stuff about them and thinking about the Ajas. And as he's talking it all out, he stumbles upon the Red Aja, and then he's thinking about men who could channel, and then it's suddenly like, Rand, burn me, how could I forget that? Where is he? Is he all right? He sighed regretfully and spread butter on a piece of still warm bread. I wonder if he's gone mad yet. Even if he knew the answers, he could do nothing to help Rand. He was not sure he would if he could. Rand could channel, and Matt had grown up with stories of men channeling, stories to frighten children, stories that frightened adults, too, because some of them were all too true. Discovering what Rand could do had been like finding out his best friend tortured small animals and killed babies. Once you finally made yourself believe it, it was hard to call him a friend any longer. I have to look out for myself, he said angrily. He upended the wine pitcher over his silver cup and was surprised to find it empty. He filled the cup with milk instead. Egwene and Nynaeve want to be Aes Sedai. He had not really remembered that until he said it aloud. Rand is following Moraine around and calling himself the Dragon Reborn. The Light knows what Perrin is up to. He's been acting crazy ever since his eyes turned funny. I have to look out for myself. Burn me, I have to. I'm the last one of us who's still sane. There's only me. So, he feels like he's a shitty friend. And I think he knows, even if he doesn't have specific memories, he probably has a sense impression, and he knows that, yeah, he has been a shitty friend. But he says he doesn't know that he would help Rand if he could. He would help Rand. If he could help Rand, he would. And, you know, it's logical to fear male channelers. However much you should be able to not see a monster when you look at your friend and know that he can channel, you know, you should be able to think your way past that. But the stigma going with channeling is not comparable to normal mental illness. Men channeling comes with a real and practical danger. There is a reason that Rand gives Fedwin more poisoned wine, because it's kinder. When you have breaks with reality, and you have power that can destroy people, and don't know what you're doing, you are dangerous, and that is a fact that cannot be changed, however unkind it is. And this is sort of acknowledged, both the fact that Matt has been a shitty friend, and also the fact that it's not quite the same after Flicker Flicker once they arrive on Toman Head. It says, Rand went to his friends. When he tried to straighten Matt, Matt jerked and stared at him, then grabbed Rand's coat with both hands. Rand, I'd never tell anyone about you. I wouldn't betray you. You have to believe that. He looked worse than ever, but Rand thought it was mostly fright. I do, Rand said. He wondered what lives Matt had lived and what he had done. He must have told someone or he wouldn't be so anxious about it. He could not hold it against him. Those had been other Matts, not this one. Besides, after some of the alternatives he had seen for himself. After some of the alternatives he had seen for himself, what? What does Rand's brain finish that thought with? Better to be done with it now? You know, like Matt outing him might be a mercy? How horrible it had to be for Rand to see all of the ways that the power could destroy him as it's taking him through Flicker Flicker. It's like, he died insane, he died rotting, he died thousands of different ways, and so he got to live over and over knowing what the One Power was going to do to him. You know, he got to see that, and he got to know. He got to see black moods and how he was crazy, how his fingers would rot off, how people feared him. And so the idea of Matt telling someone about him wasn't actually that terrible in the moment, because after some of the alternatives he had seen for himself, it might be kinder. RJ ends the Great Hunt with Matt engaging in a bit of heroics. He manages to fuck up some Shanchen with his murder dagger, and then he blows the horn, but for the most part, the flavor of his character through the first two books is of someone immature, impulsive, and selfish. A bad friend who turns on his bestie for something that is completely out of his control. But I wonder sometimes if Rand's lashing out was the original proof to Matt that men who can channel hurt people. Even if they don't hurt them physically, they hurt them emotionally. Considering the way that most people feel after the first two books with Matt, it makes RJ's characterization of him in The Dragon Reborn that much more brilliant. The person who wakes up is someone that we think we know. We think we know him because we've seen him through his friend's eyes for two books, and they think that they know him because they've known him all their lives. And maybe the Aes Sedai in healing him scrubbed away some of his immaturity and many of his worst personality traits, along with lots of his memories as they rooted out the evil of the dagger. Regardless, the person whose eyes we find ourselves behind in Chapter 19 of The Dragon Reborn is absolutely the same person we've known all along. We just get to realize that we never really knew who he was. And neither did his friends. And neither, we learn, does he. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. I'm sorry that it took so long to get it out to you. Stuff is going on in my personal life that's been having a negative impact on my mental health. And to keep myself from becoming more of an insane and anxious wreck than I already am, I had to give myself permission to take my time doing anything that doesn't have an absolutely unforgiving deadline. So I really appreciate your patience. You can find me on Twitter at Warder Gray. That's Gray with an E. All of my links are down in the show notes. A link for my email, for my Discord, for the Watt Trivia and Games Discord if you want to go and play games with fun people, for the Watt Fandom and Calendar Discord if you want to find a ton of different Wheel of Time content creators. There's also a link to my Patreon if you would like to support the show and have access to some really great bonus content. If you could rate and review me on iTunes/Apple Music, that would help me out a lot. If you know anyone who likes the Wheel of Time and might be interested in a different kind of podcast, please tell them about me. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. I am the Grey Warder. And if I discovered my bestie was the metaphorical equivalent of a bear, and the reason he tried to drive me away was because he was afraid he might eventually try to eat me... I don't like making Matt's assholery sound rational.